Late payments. Congress takes its good old time to address the housing crisis. There's $300 billion for troubled homeowners in the U.S., $25 billion to relieve jittery investors in Japan and China. They'll get around to it. Remember back when the USA was the policeman to the world? Today, America's economy seems to hang by a home equity credit lifeline from the world. When USA equals IOU, it's the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, July 23rd. Congress is taking a hard look at the $25 billion bailout plan for giant mortgage companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Some think it's a bad idea. Also, Osama bin Laden's driver. Prosecution witnesses say he knew about the 9/11 attacks. College and credit cards, for some a nightmare. And some developments in stem cell research. That story and all the news. A hurricane warning is in effect along the Texas-Mexican border as residents get ready for Hurricane Dolly. The Category 1 storm has slowed down a bit. It's expected to hit early this afternoon and bring as much as 15 inches of rain. Texas officials say they'll monitor levees in the Rio Grande Valley around the clock if necessary. The House today is expected to vote on a major housing bill that could become law by the end of the week. The bill would help struggling homeowners get new, cheaper loans and also offer a cash infusion to troubled mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
In Singapore, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is taking time out of a security conference to meet with her North Korean counterpart. They're expected to talk about monitoring the North's nuclear program. It's the Bush administration's highest-level contact with North Korea in 4 years. The U.S. and the European Union are urging Serbia to follow up on yesterday's arrest of the former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic by apprehending his wartime commander, Ratko Mladic. Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright says it's essential.
The Serbian people, under new leadership, will be able to really rejoin the international community and be part of Europe. They obviously still have to find Ratko Mladic.
Like Karadzic, Mladic has a $5 million State Department bounty on his head.
Polygamous leader Warren Jeffs and four others have been indicted on charges of child sexual assault in the state of Texas. And the state's attorney general says its investigation isn't over. Earlier this year, authorities tried to remove more than 400 children from the group's ranch in Texas because of allegations young girls were being forced into underage sex. John McCain's campaign is backtracking a bit. Here's what he said last night on CBS.
Because of the surge, we were able to go out and protect that sheikh and others, and it began the Anbar Awakening. I mean, that's just a matter of history.
In fact, the awakening started before the surge, and now McCain's campaign is saying he meant the awakening would not have held up without the help of the surge. McCain is holding a press event around noon today in Pennsylvania.
Barack Obama continues his world tour in Israel and then Ramallah. Oil's trading below $128 a barrel. Hey, let's hold a party. The Dow is up more than 1%. Markets around the world are reacting. We want to talk about cheating, though. Everyone cheats at times. Come clean with us. When do you cheat? Tell us your stories about cheating, yours or someone you know, like a friend.
Or is it relative? When is it okay to cheat a little bit? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. As we've said a number of times on this program, the all-important trial of Salim Ahmed Hamdan, Osama bin Laden's driver, and the alleged terrorist defendant down at Guantanamo Bay, that trial has opened a window on the Bush administration's war on terror and also on perhaps the inner workings of al-Qaeda itself. The trial has convened at Guantanamo Bay, and joining us now is Carol Williams, legal writer for the L.A. Times. She's covering the trial from Gitmo and joins us on the phone. Carol, good morning.
Good morning.
Give us a sense of the scene here. This tribunal is not like any other, and it's, I suspect, looks radically different than anything from Perry Mason or Law and Order.
Well, there are some similarities to U.S. civilian courts, but this is definitely, you know, a new and untried system. They're still working the kinks out of it. There have been some, you know, motions, you know, raised and approved by the judge because of some of the, you know, late filing of evidence from the prosecution to the defense. There are some testimony that won't be allowed until the defense has had time to review what they call discovery. And, you know, it's unclear whether some of these points that the prosecution wanted to make will be able to be raised in the court because of the very late, you know, provision of discovery.
We should remind people that Judge Keith Allred is presiding, and 13 military officers are members of the jury, and they're referred to as commission members by each of the attorneys for the defense and the prosecution. It appears as though the evidence or the framing of the storyline here for both sides is either Salim Ahmed Hamdan is a lowly service worker who got a small check for his services driving Osama bin Laden around, or he was a higher-level operative with his ear to the ground of al-Qaeda activities, including perhaps even the destination of the fourth 9/11 hijacked plane. Does that pretty much lay it out?
Exactly. The two sides are laying out very starkly different, you know, profiles of Salim Hamdan. The prosecution is painting him as an insider in the al-Qaeda network, somebody who was privy to information about some of the terrorist attacks that have been blamed on al-Qaeda, and the defense is casting him as just a poor Yemeni who went into al-Qaeda's employ because he needed to take care of his family.
Where do you believe the bombshells, if there are going to be any in this case, are going to come? What sort of testimony and what lines of questioning from either side in this case?
Well, the prosecutor alleged in his opening statement on Tuesday that Hamdan was privy to information about what the attack targets were from September 11th. The chief of prosecution later clarified that that was information that he overheard bin Laden telling another al-Qaeda kingpin after the attacks. That was something that we hadn't known previously. Huh. That, so far, is the only surprising element that has been raised.
And Carol, and so far two witnesses have been on the stand. And what evidence did they offer to support the prosecution's case?
There have been three. There were two U.S. military soldiers, one a Special Forces intelligence operative. They were the first people to come into contact with Hamdan when he was arrested in southern Afghanistan in November of 2001. And then there was an FBI al-Qaeda specialist interrogator on the stand later yesterday.
And do they offer any particular you know, information other than we know he was the driver or he told us this or that? I mean, is there specific hard evidence that leaks him into or that links him inside the al-Qaeda operation itself?
Well, the two U.S. military who testified yesterday had actually been before the tribunal judge in pretrial hearings earlier in December to testify to having found two surface-to-air missiles in Hamdan's possession when he was arrested. But the defense did manage to bring in some uncertainty about that because neither of them was present when Hamdan was actually stopped by Afghan forces who were fighting alongside with the U.S. forces. They encountered Hamdan sometime later after he had been, you know, nabbed and hustled off to a local jail in southern Afghanistan. So they didn't have firsthand witness of the capture of those missiles. And there's some confusion as to what vehicle of several that were stopped at that roadblock in which the missiles were found.
So a dearth of firsthand evidence, a question of timing as to when he knew what he might have known. There's much more testimony to come. Carol Williams, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Carol Williams is legal affairs writer for the LA Times, covering the trial live from Gitmo there on a very tough phone line where all the press corps works.
On the economy, John, Secretary of Treasury Hank Paulson's had a tough time getting his proposed bailout of the country's mortgage giants, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, through Congress, but he's still trying.
This is much broader than just Fannie or Freddie. So this is about the U.S. capital markets, the U.S. economy.
Today, the House is scheduled to vote on the ambitious plan that one senator says smacks of socialism. For more, we turn now to James Politi, who reports for the Financial Times. Good morning, James.
Good morning.
So what is it, the potential $25 billion price tag that's making some in Congress balk, or is it something else?
Well, actually, most of the opposition to the proposal by Secretary Paulson seems to be waning, and the $25 billion price tag, believe it or not, was smaller than many opponents of the proposal had feared. And it actually looks now like some of the Republicans who were worried about the impact that this proposal was going to have on sort of risk to taxpayers, and some of that opposition seems to be waning. So it looks like they might actually get it through this week or next week at the latest.
So Senator Jim Bunning, who says this plan is little more than socialism, he's really on an island by himself, or does he reflect what some Republicans feel? And despite White House support of this bill, is there any sense that Republicans will go against it?
Well, I mean, there definitely is a group of Republicans, conservative Republicans, who are worried about the risk to taxpayers and feel sort of the same position as Jim Bunning does. But on the other hand, a number of key Republican senators who initially expressed concern have now sort of grudgingly come to accept the fact that the administration's position that this is necessary to protect the financial system. People like Richard Shelby, the top Republican on the Senate Banking Committee.
Well, let's unpack that issue of protect the financial system. The markets seem to be reacting enthusiastically as this moves through Congress, at least in part, to this particular proposal. I've heard it said that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are a test of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is basically a test of the credibility, the financial credibility of the entire U.S. government. And the world is definitely watching to see if Fannie and Freddie are going to maintain their position as maybe higher risk, higher yield securities for places like Japan and China, but ones with the same backing of the federal government. Is that what's at stake here?
I think in many ways it is. I mean, central banks around the world hold Fannie and Freddie debt. They rely on Fannie and Freddie debt, and there are definitely fears that they might start unloading Fannie and Freddie debt if they perceive that that the government guarantee or the implicit government guarantee is no longer there. And this is something that's definitely very worrying to a lot of policymakers. And in fact, we've heard Hank Paulson talk about the fact that international investors are key here.
So in essence, is there a sense that they are just too big to fail and that there is too much at stake? And so ultimately, every effort will be made to back them up.
I think that's true. A few changes have been made to the legislation and to the proposal over the past week to make it sort of slightly more palatable to some of the Republicans who are opposing it, and I think that's helped create more of a political consensus around the plan. But there is this feeling that they are too big to fail, and the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, mm-hmm. Which researches the impact of proposed legislation on the America's fiscal position, yesterday warned exactly of the consequences.
So
of,
it's very important.
Not going through with the legislation could be actually, in a sense,
worse,
more costly.
James Politi, thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Politi reports for the Financial Times.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. So if you're sitting there at the table sipping your coffee and doing the crossword in the paper and are tempted to actually cheat while you do the crossword, you should give us a call. 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're talking about cheating this morning, actually, in business school. And we don't want to hear Enron stories from you, but we are talking about steps being taken by business schools to prevent cheating in those institutions and others. MyTakeAtTheTakeAway.org is also a way to reach us. And we're also talking about stem cells this morning. The political controversy over stem cells has certainly raised the profile of this very, very important research into genetically based therapies for a whole variety of diseases. But ironically, the political controversy over the use of embryonic stem cells may have raised the profile of stem cell research so much that Americans really don't have an understanding of where the research actually stands right now in terms of being able to help humans someday. If you watch Nova Science Now, a WGBH production, it's part of the Nova series airing tonight on PBS, you're going to get a glimpse of where stem cell research is and show how the controversy has actually motivated new research to get around the political controversy and the political issues and some of the political restrictions on stem cell research. And you're also going to meet Dr. George Daly, who's Associate Director of the Stem Cell Program at Children's Hospital in Boston, and he joins us now. Dr. Daly, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
You know, one of the great things about watching you and sort of immersing oneself in your research is and watching this Nova story tonight is to see just how little we understand about how cells go from just being little organisms to being specialized pieces of, say, skin tissue or blood tissue or heart tissue, and that stem cells are really the code that determines what a cell's going to be when it grows up. What have you learned, and how have you created the ability to make stem cells where they didn't exist before?
Well, it's true. I mean, the science is remarkable. You know, the 20th century was the century of genetics, and it ended with this complete sequencing of the human genome. But now we need to figure out how to read that code and develop tissues, and that's what stem cell biology is all about. We've had a goal for many years of creating patient-specific lines, that is, being able to take skin cells from a given patient with a disease you want to study and move that disease into a petri dish. And we've now succeeded in doing that. So we have remarkably powerful tools, but the science is still in its infancy.
And the embryonic stem cell issue comes from the fact that when we are in the zygote embryo stage, before our cells have been given the instructions to become pieces of heart or bone or eyes or hair, that they exist in this state called stem cells. And how have you been able to actually turn back the clock on, say, an existing cell in my body or one of your patients that you study, and turn them back into stem cells, if that's what your mission is?
Yeah. Well, there's actually two major categories of stem cells. There are stem cells in our bodies, in our adult tissues, and those stem cells have wonderful properties of repair and regeneration, but they are restricted to make the cells of that particular tissue. The stem cells we're talking about are called either embryonic or now pluripotent stem cells. This is the property that they can make any tissue in the body.
They're wild cards. They can become heart tissue. They can become anything.
Exactly. I mean, they're the master cells of us as organisms. It'd be like having a seed for every plant on Earth.
And in therapeutic terms, if you were going to use this to fight disease, you'd basically say, okay, stem cell, go replace these cells that are dysfunctional, or go replace this tissue that's dysfunctional, or regenerate this nerve tissue that's damaged, right?
Well, there are two major ways the stem cells contribute to medical therapy and research. First is as a tool for research. So we can study the formation of tissues in a petri dish. That teaches us an enormous amount about disease and about how to make them into particular tissues. Now, the second part would be actually getting those tissues into patients. The first part, where we're studying the diseases, is happening now. Mm-hmm. The ability to use them in treating spinal cord injury or diabetes is something off in the future.
Dr. Dalian, isn't there a gap, or do you suspect there is a gap between the perception of where the science is on stem cells right now and how soon it can be turned into some kind of specific medical treatment?
I think that's right. I mean, there has been so much attention and hype to the area that I think there's a risk that patients will think the science is much further along than it is. The science is quite exciting, and it will have tremendous impact in the future, but it's going to take us years to get there. The worry is that patients are already thinking there are cures around the corner, and when they're not offered at their local hospital, they're traveling great distances in some instances to seek therapies elsewhere. And these stem cell clinics are cropping up, and we're very concerned about stem cell tourism because it's going to involve exploiting patients and taking advantage of them.
Well, it's great to talk to you, Dr. George Daly, who's Associate Director of the Stem Cell Program at Children's Hospital Boston. His research is featured as part of Nova Science Now, a WGBH production, which airs tonight on PBS at 9 p.m. I guess the takeaway here is, ironically, your research may make the entire political controversy about embryonic stem cells ultimately kind of moot, and we thank you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah. We'll leave you with something that's at stake in this debate. Here's a clip from the Nova tonight.
It feels like a lot of people are stabbing me with knives on the inside of my body, all the way down to my bone. Sometimes I couldn't catch my breath. It was so intense.
I'm in tears, basically. It's just pain everywhere. It's going through your head, your back, your legs. You can't do anything about it.
Patients with sickle cell anemia, very concerned about stem cell research. It'll be on Nova tonight. And now, headlines with Femi Okeh.
Hello there, just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is meeting with her North Korean counterpart today. It's the highest level contact between the two countries in 4 years. Now that former Serbian leader Radovan Karadzic has been captured, the US and European Union are pressing Serbia to capture his right-hand man, the military commander Ratko Mladic. And Barack Obama is meeting with high-level Israeli officials. He heads to the West Bank later today for talks with the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. And the House could vote today on a massive housing bill meant to rescue homeowners and provide billions of dollars to bail out mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And just the latest on Hurricane Dolly, currently now bearing down on the Texas coast, also the Mexican coastline, with winds around about 85 miles an hour. It looks like it may just get very close to a Category 2 hurricane before making landfall. And that's about mid-afternoon, but I will keep you up to date with its progress.
It's missed the refineries, which has had a really positive impact on oil prices.
Yes, I'm sure the shares will be doing fine.
Thank you, Femi.
Half past 9 Eastern.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Quickly, I want to remind you, we're talking about cheating today, why you would cheat. Tell us your cheating stories. When is it okay? When is it not okay? When is it morally an issue or not? You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Paulette wrote us about yesterday's show. She said the global food prices is irrelevant. Birth control is really the only issue. Reducing the population on the planet is the only way to address food crisis in the United States. You can respond to anything on the program. Let's take that.
We're going to get back to cheating, something that Shakespeare's talked about much in Henry VIII, the very famous line that a character said, "Let's first kill all the lawyers." And today, he might have added business leaders to the list because of all of the growing lists of misdeeds we're now understanding by corporate leaders as we look at this sputtering economy. But some people suggest perhaps that trickery starts long before these business leaders become head honchos, perhaps even before they get into business school. But a new technology, think hand scans, it's literally a scan of your palm veins, something new, may help spur some honesty, at least take a stab at people who are paying others to take tests for them. And joining us for more is Donald McCabe, a professor of management and global business at Rutgers, and Peg Jopes, who's the senior vice president of the Graduate Management Admission Council. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
And let's start with you, Professor McCabe. You say business students are the worst offenders when it comes to cheating. Tell us about this culture of cheating you describe.
Right. First, I'd just like to suggest where that statistic comes from. I've surveyed over 200,000 students over the last 20 years, and consistently business students finish at or near the very top. They've been at the top literally in every survey I've done except one, and they were very close second, not statistically different from the number one group. And what it seems to reflect is the fact that business students are already, in many cases, acquiring what they assume to be the mentality that rules in the business world, and that is getting the job done regardless of how you get it done. The bottom line is what counts, not how you achieve that bottom line.
Is it something they justify? I mean, is it a relative thought, this notion of what cheating is or isn't?
Well, it is for everybody, not just for business students. There's no question that high school students that I've surveyed and college students as well, I've often said that I think fairness is the biggest issue here. Students feel that somebody else is getting away with something and that they have to cheat in order to level the playing field.
Okay, Peg, so you're taking a look at what's happening in graduate management schools. What kind of cheating are you seeing, and how is this technology going to address those issues?
Well, I think what we have come to know about the GMAT test and any high-stakes test is that candidates are going to be motivated to try and do the very best they can, and sometimes that behavior is unethical. So for years, we've done lots of things at the test center to make sure that the test taker that appears at that test center to take the test is the same one that shows up on business school campuses for class. The new palm vein reader is going to replace our fingerprinting, and it's just enhanced technology that makes capturing information about a candidate more accurate and less invasive and more culturally acceptable.
And the GMAT is the test that you need to take for entry into most business schools. How does this palm scan, how does it work exactly?
Well, the way it works is when a candidate appears at a test center and is going through the check-in process, they will show their identification. They will then also put their hand over a palm scan reader, and it will pick up the blood veins that flow through your hand and create a template that is unique to each individual. Then if a candidate wants access into the test room, they'll put their hand over that palm vein reader. It'll make sure it's the same person that recorded at the test check-in, and then they'll be allowed access into the test center.
How often does that actually happen, imposters taking the GMAT?
Well, I can tell you that technology's allowed us to catch imposters over the last few years in a handful of cases.
In a handful of cases? So
right.
It's not something that's regularly happening and then you see it escalating over the past year, two, three?
I would say that our business schools are demanding ethical behavior more and more. And GMAC is committed to helping schools while these candidates are in the process of matriculating to business school. So we have heightened our attempt at making sure that that same candidate that takes the test is the same one that goes into the campus. And so we've used technology in a variety of ways to prevent that from happening, mm-hmm. and then also to detect it happening at the time that it's being perpetrated.
And Professor McCabe, what do you think about hand scans and fingerprints? It all sounds very intimidating.
Well, I think it does, but I think it's necessary. I really do. Unfortunately, there's a number of students who have decided that they'll do whatever it takes to get into whatever program they're interested in, whether it be a business program, law program, medical, doesn't matter. And my concern is that if they succeed and that word gets out to other students, those other students then feel they have to do something, again, to level the playing field, and it just leads to even more cheating. So I think we have to do something.
So a warning to anyone planning on going to graduate business school, you may have to leave a fingerprint, a palm print, some part of yourself before you get there. Thank you, Donald McKay, Professor of Management and Global Business at Rutgers Business School.
My pleasure.
Also Peg Jopes, Senior Vice President of the Graduate Management Admission Council. We thank you both for joining us. Now we're going to get some headlines from Femi Okeh.
Hello there, Dora. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the hour. India's government won the confidence vote. The vote approves the partnership that gives India nuclear energy technology from the United States. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez says he wants Russia to become a strategic partner to ensure Venezuela's sovereignty. And Hugo Chavez is currently on a visit to Russia. A judge has rejected a request to release secret testimony that might clear the convicted Cold War spy, Ethel Rosenberg. She was executed after being found guilty of passing nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union. And one of our guests from early on in the week is making news today. Bishop Gene Robinson is American. He's the first openly gay bishop. He's in the UK this week for a once-in-a-decade meeting of Anglican bishops from around the world. It's known as the Lambeth Conference. The only thing is, Bishop Robinson wasn't invited. He explained early on this week why he was snubbed.
I think that the Archbishop had it in mind that if he were to not invite me, that he might win the participation of the most conservative elements of the Anglican Communion.
It seemed like the Archbishop of Canterbury's plan didn't quite work out. The Archbishop of Sudan, Daniel Deng, blamed Bishop Robinson for the boycott of the conference by hundreds of conservative bishops. He said that the ordination of the gay bishop undermined Anglicans in countries like Sudan.
We are called infidel by the Islamic world when they are hearing our brothers and sisters from other parts of the Christian global that they are talking of the same sex to be blessed. Immediately, it gives them the way out to tell the other people, these people are evil and they can even harm our people more.
Bishop Robinson said no comment this morning.
Thank you, fam.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Barack Obama ends his very high-profile world tour tomorrow. And he's been following an old adage for global politicians: when in doubt, go to Berlin.
There are some who say that communism is the wave of the future. Let them come to Berlin.
Back in 1963, President John F. Kennedy spoke with powerful symbolism in that city at the height of the Cold War, in a place that signified the bloodshed and violence of 200 years of European conflict. It can be said that Berlin in our era is a city that is defined by transformations. From a city that in 1945 resembled modern Baghdad, it became in Kennedy's time a divided city, under political siege, a place to talk about a future of freedom amidst signs of its absence.
When that day finally comes, as it will, the people of West Berlin can take sober satisfaction in the fact that they were in the front lines for almost two decades. Oh. free men, wherever they may live, are citizens of Berlin. And therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the words, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Today there is no West Berlin, of course, and the irony of being a free man in Berlin has faded a bit. The symbolic place of Cold War pilgrimage JFK inspired became in the 1980s a place to fire calculated confrontational volleys into the Soviet Union. Here Ronald Reagan speaks to his Soviet counterpart at the Brandenburg Gate.
Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Berlin and the Brandenburg Gate have maintained their place as pilgrimage places for American leaders, but today the city represents something new. It's the symbol and crossroads of a whole new kind of Europe. It's a place that is contemporary, with a currency more powerful than the dollar and an ethnic diversity that barely resembles the Berlin of 60 years ago. A place for cities like Baghdad and Kabul to aspire to. A new kind of beacon of freedom.
20th century becomes something like a century of bloodshed. Now this century, 21st century, should be century of dialogue. Any problem have to solve through dialogue, not using force. That's very, very important.
That's the Dalai Lama speaking last May using the gates, Brandenburg Gate, as a place to decry Chinese rule over Tibet. Tomorrow, presidential candidate Barack Obama will speak in Berlin, his pilgrimage the latest. A new kind of American politician will stand in a new kind of global city, in a Europe as much a rival as an ally of the United States. Obama wants to showcase his expertise and eloquence in foreign policy, it is said. Berlin will also want to reintroduce itself to the world.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, July 23rd, and we have the latest headline for you from Femi. Okay, Femi?
Thanks, Adora. Just coming up to 12 minutes to the hour, Condoleezza Rice is meeting with her North Korean counterpart at international talks in Singapore. China will allow some public protesting during the Olympics in three designated protest zones that are not near the sports venues. Cambodia is asking the UN Security Council to hold an emergency meeting to resolve the increasingly tense border dispute between Cambodia and Thailand. Washington Mutual suffered losses of $3 billion last quarter, the biggest in the bank's history. Our presidential candidate Barack Obama has meetings in both Israel and Palestinian territories today. And John McCain will host events in Pennsylvania and appears on Fox's Hannity and Combs later on tonight. And that's a look at your domestic and international news headlines.
Thank you, Femi. So, of course, just about every morning we talk about the credit crunch or the subprime mortgage crisis or the difficulty of easy credit. Nobody in the universe knows more about easy credit in America than college students. And on the line with me is Classy Alcyon from the University of Missouri at Kansas City. Classy, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. How are you doing?
What year are you at school?
I am a senior this year.
I see. So when did you fill out your first credit card application? Do you remember?
When I was a freshman.
When you were a freshman. And the application, you had to kind of dig around for it, go down to the bank and talk to somebody. How did you find the application?
Oh, no. They literally, I was sent all these credit card applications, and I saw one, and I was like, hey, you know, it's a low APR rate, and I just thought that, you know, I need money, I need to pay for gas and books, and that was my way to pay for it.
And do you remember the first thing you charged as a freshman?
Yes, the first thing I charged was gas, and then I charged on books. And then it just became a vicious cycle of, oh, let's go have dinner, and then, you know, I'll pay for it because I'll just pay it back later. But $2,000, you know, in debt now, I sort of regret doing that.
So do you know your interest rate on your balance right now?
Right now it's like 18%, which is,
ouch.
I don't know. Yeah, that
ouch.
Hurts.
Why do you think college kids are such a source of, you know, credit card sales? I mean, it seems like when you go on a college campus, I was actually delivering my kids to camp up at Williams College this summer, and still on the bulletin boards everywhere in the student union and the common areas, you see these rip-off credit card applications. They're falling out of books at the bookstore. Why do you think college students are such a target?
Because we know nothing about finances at all. I mean, we don't learn this stuff in high school. Our parents really don't teach us this. So when we see something like, you know, a $2,000 credit limit, we're like, oh my God, that's a lot of money. Let me sign up for that. I think that college students are very naive about their finances, and that's why a lot of us are in debt now.
Classy, is it something you talk about amongst yourselves about your interest rates or about how to not get so much in debt, or is it just a question you don't have a choice? You're either going to get your books or you're not.
Yes, it comes down to the choice of, you know, hey, I don't work that many hours a week because I go to school full time, and so your only choice is to get a credit card because you can't afford to live and, you know, not have a credit card because the cost of living has gotten so high for college students, especially as your tuition increases every year. And it's just this cycle that just keeps on going. I have plenty of friends who are in debt, you know, up to $10,000, and, you know, they graduate, and then they have it on top of their student loans. So it gets worse and worse.
Well, I want to go into your sort of balance, your outstanding balance at this point. But have you had any tough conversations with your parents about what to do about this?
No. I think it's a lot of fear. Like, you don't want to make your parents really mad, and so you don't be like, hey, Mom, can I borrow, like, $2,000? Because my mom would probably be very angry at me, and she doesn't even know.
How do you know she's not listening this morning, Classy? Because the cat might be out of the bag right now, hon.
I don't know, but, you know, hopefully she is listening, but if she is, I'll get a call after this interview.
So what is your outstanding balance, including your student loans?
About $10,000.
$10,000 total. So that's student loans plus credit cards, right?
Yes. My student loans is about $8,000, and my credit card debt is about $2,000.
What's the chance that you're going to go into the job market with compromised credit in some way? Like not be able to buy a car, you know, not be able to even think about buying a home.
Yeah, it's going to be very hard. I didn't think about that while I was spending all that money, but I probably should have thought about that before. But I think overall that it's, well, now I've gone to a very strict budget, so hopefully I'll get that credit card paid off.
Very strict budget. Well, we wish you the best of luck, Classy.
All right, thank you very much.
What's your major, by the way?
I'm criminal justice and political science.
All right, well, definitely stay on the straight and narrow there. Classy Alcine is a University of Missouri, Kansas City student leader who, as we heard, has an outstanding balance of $10,000. We're talking about credit cards, companies targeting college students from the time that they're freshmen.
And right now, John, we're going to take another stab at another kind of financial situation and crisis, and that is the mortgage industry and the bailout, the proposed bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which both companies, giants in the mortgage industry in this country, are struggling. And Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson has proposed a way to help them out. And on the line to give us a little more about what's happening on Capitol Hill is Todd Zwillick of Capitol News Connection. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, Adora.
So today the House is expected to vote on this ambitious plan, but there's certainly been some criticism. I mean, one senator even went as far to call it a smacking of socialism, this idea of spending $25 billion and perhaps more in trying to shore up the companies.
Right, he did. That was Senator Jim Bunning from Kentucky who said that. And you have to sort of look at the details about whether it is $25 billion, whether that's a maximum or a minimum. And a lot of people went around Capitol Hill yesterday saying, it's not a bailout, it's not a bailout. Would you listen? It's not a bailout. But some people think it is a bailout.
What is it?
Well, it depends on whether Fannie and Freddie stay afloat. If what Barney Frank, the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, told me yesterday is that the markets have overreacted, that Fannie and Freddie are on sound financial footing, they've had a correction, people have lost 80%, shareholders have lost 80% of their money. So what they're doing today and then in the Senate later this week is going to calm the markets and keep Fannie and Freddie afloat. If things go horribly wrong and they need their credit line, they need what would amount to a bailout. He said, Barney Frank and the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, says worst case scenario, $25 billion of taxpayer money. Best case scenario, basically zero taxpayer money.
Well, the market seemed to like it.
The market seemed to like it, and that's what Barney Frank said was the intention, which is the fact that Congress is doing something and Treasury is doing something, and, oh, my God, everybody's on the same page, if you can believe that, has calmed the markets a lot, and that's exactly what they intended. They now have a backstop, and if things continue to go wrong, and they could, you know, absolutely they could, if things continue to go wrong, Congress is there, the taxpayer is there, more importantly, to prevent Fannie and Freddie from going under, which everybody, almost everybody except Jim Bunning and a couple of other conservatives, say are too big to fail. They cannot be allowed to fail.
I mean, when you're talking about too big to fail, you're talking about between the two of them, they are involved in nearly half of all the mortgages in this country, carrying somewhere around $1 trillion in loans. I mean, that's big.
Yeah, it's huge. In fact, it might even be a bit more than that. I've heard numbers that go into the 3 and 4 trillion and up, depending on how you look at it. And a lot of that held equity, by the way, is not just here in the States. So somewhere between 1 and 2 trillion of it is held overseas.
Yeah, China and Japan, they're the big investors here. You know, I heard somebody talk about how the possibility exists that the U.S. government actually might make money on this deal because it's stock that the U.S. is buying, the Treasury is buying, and if it goes up, they can sell at a profit. Does anyone believe that?
John, I don't know, but I do know this. If that happens, there will be about 250 or 300 members of Congress who will be taking credit for that and saying, look, we made money for you.
So there's a telltale sign.
I would love to report that story.
That's great.
Todd Zwillick, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Todd Zwillick coming to us from Capitol Hills from Capitol News Connection.
Todd knows everything. Today we're talking about stem cell research, Guantanamo Bay, and cheating. Can we turn back the clock on skin cells until they become stem cells? We may be looking at the future of stem cell research.
Osama bin Laden's driver, Salim Hamdan, goes to trial, and both the defense and prosecution are figuring it out as they go.
To prevent cheating, graduate business schools turn to palm reading. Well, hand scans. We know everything about cheats at times, but when do you cheat? When is it okay to cheat?
And here's today's takeaway.
Unfortunately, there's a number of students who have decided that they'll do whatever it takes to get into whatever program they're interested in, whether it be a business program, law program, medical, doesn't matter.
Whatever it takes. That's Donald McKay, professor of management and global business at Rutgers Business School. 8778-MY-TAKE. Cheating.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
A light meal. Call it car soup.
Little GTO, you're really looking fine. 3 deuces and a 4-speed and a 389.
Souped-up cars used to be about horsepower and speed. Today, they're about biodiesel and hot batteries. Plugging in your 21st-century dragster. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good Good morning. It's Wednesday, July 23rd. Electric cars, looking at them together, auto experts, utility honchos, and scientists a first. Also, new details on the capture of one of Serbia's most wanted men. The Environmental Protection Agency versus the Bush administration. We'll talk to a whistleblower. And medical breakthroughs on prostate cancer and Alzheimer's. Those stories and all the news. The eye of Hurricane Dolly is 65 miles from Brownsville, Texas. Forecasters expect the Category 1 storm to make landfall around midday, soaking some areas with up to 15 inches of rain. Officials say flooding is likely to be the biggest danger. Barack Obama is in Israel today. He had breakfast with Israel's defense minister and will meet with Palestinian leaders later. At a press conference yesterday, Obama said he knows there's no easy solution to end violence in the region.
And I do believe that an ultimate resolution is going to involve two states standing side by side in peace and security.
He says to get there, Israelis and Palestinians will both have to make compromises.
John McCain is holding a press conference in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania at noon today for the rest of the political update. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice greeted her North Korean counterpart at an Asian security conference in Singapore today. She's pressing the North to prove it's been telling the truth about its past nuclear activities by agreeing to a verification proposal that the U.S. drafted. Lawyer acting for the former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic says he'll fight to move to extradite Karadzic to the International War Crimes Tribunal at The Hague. He's wanted on charges of genocide and crimes against humanity. He was arrested on Monday.
Polygamous leader Warren Jeffs and four others have been indicted on charges of child sexual assault in the state of Texas. And the state's attorney general says its investigation isn't over. Earlier this year, authorities tried to remove more than 400 children from the group's ranch in Texas because of allegations young girls were being forced into underage sex. Oil's trading just below $128 a barrel. The Dow was up more than 1%. It's at 11,600. The S&P is at 1277.
The markets are going crazy over the bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and the oil markets are going batty over Hurricane Dolly missing the refineries in the Gulf.
128 sounds much better than 138.
What's it going to mean for us? Apparently, gas prices are like falling off just a little bit. But we want to ask you not about gas prices, unless you cheat when you go to the gas pump. I don't know how you would do that, but if you have a way, get in touch with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at the Take. Takeaway.org. We are talking about cheating. Everybody cheats, right?
So they say.
That's what they say.
That's what they say.
Come clean with us. You know, we won't tell anyone.
Do you cheat? Do
just
you not
us.
Cheat? Is
just
it a good idea,
us.
Bad idea, or sometimes
little
do you have to?
Lie.
8778 my take.
We'd
like to hear
us.
Your story.
We won't tell anyone.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this Wednesday, July 23rd. Today in Belgrade, new details are emerging about how the country's most wanted man, Radovan Karadzic, evaded police for 12 years. This was an arrest warrant that warned of his flamboyant behavior, and the Bosnian Serb wartime leader, who's been indicted by a UN war crimes tribunal twice on 16 counts of genocide. Well, he lived up to that flamboyant behavior, living out in the open, heavily disguised. Now he's being held in Belgrade pending extradition to the Hague Tribunal. For more, we're joined by the New York Times correspondent, Stephen Erlanger. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, give us some of the details of this man who was wanted for a dozen years for some of the world's most atrocious crimes against humanity. And there he was, right in Belgrade, practicing medicine.
Yes, he was. He grew a big beard, and he changed his hair, and he put on eyeglasses and changed his accent, and lived in the alternative medicine community, where he actually published articles and gave lectures. The Serbs deny it, but it does seem that a Western intelligence agency tipped them off that Karadzic was in New Belgrade. And the difference is that you now have a government in Belgrade which is pro-European, which was a big change, and they acted speedily to arrest Karadzic. The previous government of Prime Minister Kostunica wasn't quite so quick.
And no, in fact...
I
was going to say, not to interrupt you, but I just want to finish that thought. In fact, the administration prior had taken a lot of criticism for not coming up with him. Let's listen to the BBC's Audrey Carville grilling the Serbia's foreign minister.
Well, I'm not a security expert, so I can't really answer this question in detail.
Oh, come on. It's a purely political question, isn't it? You didn't have the will to do it up until now.
Well, I've been in office for the past 2 weeks, and I think that we have demonstrated only two weeks into our term in office that we're very serious. I mean, this is a political priority for this new government of Serbia, European integration.
And Stephen, the new administration, they got serious real quick, and in part because of what you just mentioned, right? They want to get into the European Union.
Yes, and what Brussels had done is it made better relations with Serbia conditional on full cooperation with the War Crimes Tribunal at The Hague, and that means arresting and handing over not just Karadzic, but the man who probably is considered most responsible for the massacre at Srebrenica, which was Ratko Mladic, who was the head of the Bosnian Serb army and served under Karadzic. There's a third person who was head of the little Bosnian Croat state in Bosnia also, who's at large. But getting Karadzic out after such a long period of time, after so much jumping up and down by the West, after all these failed raids, is a very important sign for the Serbs. And there are a lot of Europeans who, you know, understand that they need now to help support a government that's taken a fairly controversial step. Belgrade's quiet, but, you know, the nationalists still see Karadzic as a form of hero.
And in the greater European community, this was seen as a step towards cementing that quiet and moving Serbia forward.
Absolutely right. I mean, there are big problems that remain, especially in Kosovo, which has declared independence, which Serbia regards all over its political spectrum as part of Serbia. But that's for another day. I mean, the fact of the matter is this Serb government is new. It's taken a big step toward Europe. Europe feels it should respond. And Europe feels that its conditionality of relations on Belgrade was a very important pressure point to get the government to move.
Now, Radovan Karadzic, he's never acknowledged this UN tribunal. What happens at this point? Does he fight extradition to The Hague?
Well, his lawyer's trying to do it. And there's a period of time, a few days, where the legal processes go through. I would be very surprised if Karadzic isn't in The Hague by Friday.
Oh, that quickly.
Yeah, maybe early next week. And then the long process of a court case proceeds. Now, I presume they've already done the indictment, they've done some of the work, but it's always different, and I doubt he's going to cooperate very much with the tribunal. You never know. And these things are actually not so easy to prove. Let's not forget he is accused of something, and, the case has yet to be made.
Right.
It's very difficult to prove direct responsibility for someone else's killing other people if you don't have the paper trail, if you don't have witnesses. It's very, very difficult. It's something the tribunal ran into a lot of trouble with when they tried
previously
to convict. Yes.
So very big questions. Yes. So very big questions to come. Stephen Erlinger, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Stephen Erlinger, New York Times correspondent, filling us in on the latest in Serbia.
It was a dramatic scene on Capitol Hill yesterday as Jason Burnett, whose name has been in the headlines lately for publicly criticizing the Bush administration, testified on Capitol Hill about the inner workings of the White House and its policy on environmental greenhouse gases, the Clean Air Act. Basically, the portrait he painted was of an administration really at odds with its own environment. Environmental Protection Agency. Jason Burnett is a former associate deputy administrator for the EPA. He's now a private citizen and joins us on the line from Washington. Jason, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, is it fair to call you a whistleblower? Do you accept that term?
Well, I have been called that, but what I am trying to focus on is getting the next administration ready for making the decisions that this administration declined to confront. Most fundamentally, that is answering the Supreme Court.
At the very least, you paint a picture, and you talked about it a little bit on Capitol Hill yesterday, of an administration that was not only at odds with policymakers inside the bureaucracy, and particularly the EPA, but was actually actively blocking the EPA. How did that work?
Well, I would characterize it a little bit differently. There is a robust interagency policy process that culminated in a cabinet-level meeting where there was agreement that greenhouse gases endanger the public and must be regulated. Then the support for doing so evaporated with the passage of the energy bill. The energy bill didn't change the law and it didn't change the science, but it did change the political calculation, and no longer did the Bush administration want to address greenhouse gases and instead left that challenge to the next administration.
So it was really the ball was dropped and you were left to kind of figure out on your own how to move forward. And in many cases, memos and communications with the vice president's office were not responded to at all.
That's right. After the cabinet level meeting where there was agreement that the public was endangered by greenhouse gases, we drafted up a formal legal finding to that effect. And I made sure that the finding conformed with all of the decisions that had been reached in the interagency process, double-checking with members of the Office of Management and Budget. But when I sent the email containing that finding, we received a phone call asking for us to retract the finding to say that it had been sent in error.
Really? So to actually just kind of pretend that it didn't even exist?
Well, ultimately, the email wasn't opened, and OMB was directed by others in the White House, it's my understanding, to not open the email so as to not trigger the public transparency provisions of both the Clean Air Act and an executive order.
Jason, do me a favor and explain this bit of your testimony yesterday. Listen to it first, and then see if you can explain it to me, because it really is a shocker.
And I must say that it was sometimes somewhat embarrassing for me to return to EPA and ask for my colleagues to explain yet again that CO2 is a molecule.
What's that again? You had to explain that CO2 is a molecule?
Well, yes. I think I was quoted in the New York Times as saying the process was absurd. There were individuals in the Office of Management and Budget that were interested in limiting the Supreme Court decision, Massachusetts versus EPA, to just cars and trucks, and not letting the implications of that decision spill over to power plants and refineries and other sources of greenhouse gases, stationary sources. And so they tried to argue that somehow CO2 emissions from cars and trucks were different than CO2 emissions from power plants.
It's the same molecule. Jason, hold on for just a second, because you want to prepare the next administration for what you experienced in the Bush administration. I want to talk to you about that. Hold on for a second. We're going to get some headlines, and I'll be right back with you. Jason Burnett is a former associate deputy administrator for the EPA. He'll be right back with us.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Continuing now our conversation with Jason Burnett, the former Associate Deputy Administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency. Jason testified on Capitol Hill yesterday about the interagency conflicts that existed between the Bush administration and legislation, laws on the books on implementing environmental policy. And the enormous number of details that you presented in your testimony, I really don't have time to get into all of those. I mean, we should point out that the finding memo you spoke about before the break is actually still unopened in the White House inbox. And these interagency conflicts, which seem so frustrating to me, what do you think the next administration is going to face here?
Well, simple observation is that the next administration will need to respond to the Supreme Court and will need to follow the Clean Air Act. And the Clean Air Act says that if greenhouse gases endanger the public, and they clearly do so, that regulation is required. Now, the Clean Air Act is not the best law for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It would be much better if Congress would pass new legislation that was specifically designed to address greenhouse gases. But in the meantime, the next administration will need to move forward with a regulatory strategy to begin reducing these gases.
Well, finally, how does it work? I mean, it's hard to know exactly what the manifestation is of politics like this, where you have the government fighting itself. I mean, we've seen this with the CIA and with other legislation or Supreme Court decisions that the Bush administration apparently doesn't really have the will to follow. And so there are these stall tactics that take place. I mean, when the Bush administration leaves office, is it going to be like ding dong, the witch is dead in the bureaucracy like the EPA? Or is there going to be some sort of momentum to stall that the new administration is going to have to push back on to actually get anything done?
Well, over the past 6 months or so, my last 6 months in the agency, we spent a lot of effort of developing a framework that hopefully will be useful to the next administration in making these important policy decisions, the decisions that this administration has punted on.
All right. Well, we can only hope that that happens and that your advice will be taken. And thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jason Burnett is a private citizen now, but he was once the Associate Deputy Administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency. Adora?
From the EPA to oil in North Dakota, a familiar scene is playing itself out.
We have oil here. That's worth something.
Oh, do you have someone who can drill for it? Do you think there's oil here?
I know there is.
Oh, it's very expensive to drill.
But not as expensive as it used to be. Climbing oil prices and developing drilling technology have not just led to an expanding oil industry in North Dakota. It's actually led to a boom. More and more people in the state are becoming millionaires because of the wealth of oil underneath the state. It's changing the face of small towns, Indian reservations, and more. Filmmaker Caitlin McNally is in the middle of the documenting this boom. She's joining us now. We're going to check in with you as you begin this process. And it's really, Caitlin, hard to imagine the allure of becoming a millionaire overnight and seeing it happen all around you.
That's true. It's true. And actually, Adora, as the clip says that you just played, you know, this is kind of a modern There Will Be Blood that's happening in North Dakota right now. But people are becoming millionaires. I recently saw or heard a statistic that is anecdotal, but that there's a millionaire a day being made in North Dakota right now because of the huge, vast amount of oil that they're sitting on top of. And because we're in a moment right now when, as you said, the technology and the high price of oil is making it possible to get to all this oil that's under the ground there.
But it must be a real explosion of lots of different issues. It's changing the nature of these very rural communities, I would suggest, and perhaps even pitting neighbor against neighbor.
It really is. It's very fascinating, and this was very fascinating for me to see when I made my first trip there, the amount of different interests that are brought together because of an oil boom. Let's just take one example. You mentioned there's this Indian reservation, an American Indian reservation that sits in the heart of where all this activity is in western North Dakota. And if you look at where the drilling rigs are being built and where the action's happening, you could see a big kind of donut hole in the middle. If you were to draw a map, you'd see all the wells that are, you know, that are popping up all over this area, and there's this donut hole in the middle where there's no activity, and that's the American Indian Reservation. Because it's federally administered land, it's much more complicated for companies to drill wells there. So this American Indian Reservation hasn't seen the same amount of action that other parts of the state has, and they're working very desperately right now to try to get oil companies to come to their land. They're very much desirous of the same sort of action as the rest of the state.
But you've got a real, you got a busload of people coming in there. You got the people selling and buying the leases. You got the people actually offering to do the drilling. You got the people pumping the water, and then you've got the actual oil.
Exactly. Here's a kind of story to explain that. In a tiny town of 1,200 people out in the middle of western North Dakota.
Which town?
The town that I was in is called Stanley, but this is happening in towns, little towns all over this part of North Dakota that have county courthouses. These landmen, who are both men and women, that are people hired by the oil companies to go out and look at these leases to see who owns what, who owns land, who owns mineral rights.
Is there a lot of confusion about who owns what parts of the land?
Tons of confusion. Tons. Not only that, but there's so many of these people working in this area now that they'll show up at the break of dawn at a county courthouse, line up their briefcases to show, you know, who's there first, and then they'll all go and get coffee at the local cafe. And then come back when the place actually opens. It could be 80 of them. I talked to one tiny county courthouse where 80 people were working in a day. So this just shows the amount of activity that's going on.
And they're staking their claims. They're basically making their documents.
What they're doing is kind of this really fascinating detective work. They're sitting there in these old vaults that are sometimes 100 years old with these big, dusty old books, looking through old land deeds and saying, okay, you know, this father owned this ranch, and at that time he owned the rights to his land, but also to the minerals underneath his land. But now, you know, in 50 years, now his son may own some, the brother may own some, the uncle, whoever. And so they're kind of parsing out who actually now over years and years.
Well, it sounds like a legal mess, but clearly the risk or the time and the money spent checking out is potentially worth a lot. I think that the U.S. Geological Survey says that in that region, including North Dakota, Montana, and parts of Canada, that you're talking about potentially up to 4 billion barrels of oil.
Which is a huge amount. You're right. And that survey that was released in April really kind of confirmed what the companies already thought was the case in North Dakota and has really now kicked off the frenzy. To put that number in perspective, what this is that we're dealing with in North Dakota is the largest known recoverable resource in the U.S.
Wow.
In the lower 48 states, I should say.
Obviously, and this is something that you are going to be following. And we want to check in with you because you're also going to be talking to some people who think this is a terrible idea, that it's going to ruin the region, that there are environmental concerns and all of those things. So we're going to have you come back and tell us what you dig up as you move forward in making this documentary.
Be sure to ring us up if you find
McNally.
A Daniel Day-Lewis.
I'm looking for him. I'm looking for Daniel Plainview in North Dakota.
Caitlin McNally, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Caitlin McNally is a documentary producer, and she's working on the oil scene in North Dakota.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Headlines coming your way now from Femi Oke.
Hello, there it is, 28 minutes to the hour. India's government won the confidence vote. The vote approves the partnership that gives India nuclear energy technology from the United States. Venezuela President Hugo Chavez is in Russia to broker a number of deals involving weapons purchases, oil exploration, and the creation of a joint financial institution. Chavez is looking into purchasing Russian fighter jets and parts for an anti-aircraft system. A judge has rejected a request to release secret testimony that might clear the convicted Cold War spy Ethel Rosenberg. She was executed after being found guilty of passing nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union. Polygamous sect leader Warren Jeffs and four of his followers were indicted by a Texas grand jury on charges of felony sexual assault of a child, but Jeffs is already in prison right now. And finally, to a story that political watchers are taking note of. John McCain is piling up as far as the mistakes are concerned. In the last 3 weeks, he's mistaken Somalia for Sudan, the Green Bay Packers for the Pittsburgh Steelers, and Iraq instead of Iran. Now, people who are saying that he might not be quite ready to be president say that at 72 years old, he might be just a little bit past it. John McCain made fun of himself and his age on the Conan O'Brien show recently by nodding off during the interview, although that might be a comment on Conan O'Brien. That's a look at your news.
Wow. Hopefully not a commentary from Femi. Okay. Thank you.
You know I don't do commentary.
Yeah.
Not in this room.
You were just giving us an either or.
In
either nor, right?
In
okay, I got
flames.
It.
We're going to take another hit on the environment here and take a look at a conference that certainly is a sign of the times. Plug-in 2008. Now, that does not have anything to do with hair dryers, I guarantee you. It's a meeting later today in Silicon Valley. And it's a meeting that gathers people who love to soup up their cars, but also automakers will be there, utility companies will be there, and scientists, all meeting under one roof to explore electric transportation. Joining us now is Mark Duvall, who's the program manager of electric transportation at the Electric Power Research Center. And he joins us from San Jose. Thank you, Mark, for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You know, it seems like a great meeting of, you know, big auto companies, utilities that have the juice, and a lot of sort of low-level entrepreneurs who have been tweaking their cars and turning them into electric mobiles for some time now. Interesting combination of cultures.
Yes, and it's been a long time coming.
Now, when you say it's been a long time coming, you mean we should have done this a long time ago, or a lot of people have been working in the sort of wilderness to make electric cars for much longer than people think?
I think that many of the parties have wanted to explore how to use electricity in transportation for a long time. And I think this is the first time that we've really seen enough momentum, especially on the part of the big automotive companies, to actually see that, yes, there is a time in the near future where this is going to be possible.
Well, they're desperate to get into a business where you can actually make money. For the utility companies, what's in it for them? I mean, they're at capacity now on these hot days. I imagine, you know, plugging one SUV into the grid on a 100-degree day in New York could just bring down the whole system.
No, that's not very likely to happen that way. It's true that we do have capacity issues on the very hottest days, but that's really only a few hours a day. And most of the time, there's really plenty of capacity to handle millions upon millions of vehicles plugged into the grid. And what we're trying to do with working with automakers and utilities together is design cars that ultimately plug into the grid, and the whole process is smart. So we call it smart charging, and it means that you would plug cars in, and they would tend to know the time of day, know when to charge or when not to charge, and so they're out using this unused capacity that exists at night.
So you're describing a car that, when it's plugged in, is actually kind of playing the energy futures market through its own sort of computer intelligence, buying the cheapest power at the best time of the day.
Yes, and what we hope is that in the near future, cars, as well as a lot of other appliances, will automatically do this.
Now, as far as the actual cars are concerned, what do they look like? How would they be different from a vehicle that you would purchase today that uses gasoline, or even a hybrid?
Well, we have three cars in our booth right now, and they look just like normal cars, and they have all the same features. They just happen to have plugs on them as well as fuel tanks. Really, plug-in hybrids are fundamentally almost exactly like hybrid vehicles. They have a larger battery and they have a plug. You plug them in and they can rely on electricity for the first part of your driving, and then when the battery is used up, they switch over to what we would call sort of hybrid mode, and they act very much like a hybrid vehicle.
And Mark, it sounds pretty simple. Wasn't that one of the early criticisms of electric cars, that they were very complicated to charge and that the batteries didn't last as long as the driver might need it, so on and so forth?
Well, we've got some electric cars at the show, too, and that is one of the things that you have to deal with when you get an electric car, is you have to understand how long the battery can take you and where you're going to find your next charging station. Plug-in hybrids, which are most of the cars in the show, use electricity in the first part of the day. The battery is designed to take care of the sort of 20 to 40 miles a day that everyone seems to drive. That seems to be about as much as a lot of people drive. And then if you want to drive further than that, then you're going to use gasoline and drive in a hybrid mode, which is still very efficient, but takes you really as far as you need to go.
What is the technological limitation on batteries right now that, if it were eliminated, would really move electric cars into a completely different dimension?
I think it's actually more of a cost limitation than a technology limitation. We think the batteries are very good today, and they offer very good reliability and durability. They're expensive, so it makes the cars more expensive, and understanding how to design batteries that are less expensive and then build huge factories to mass produce them and get the cost down with economies of scale is really the next big important step.
But isn't there an environmental issue with that? I mean, if you mass scale battery production, doesn't that have environmental implications in waste and energy?
There is a little bit of energy use in battery manufacture, but relative to the amount of gasoline a car consumes over its life, it's really a very small percentage of that. And most of the big manufacturers know that they have to have real recycling programs in place so that when batteries reach their end of life and they're taken out of cars, they're fully recycled and the materials are accounted for or reused.
So how much are these hybrids?
Well, today,
the electrical gas cars, what am I looking at paying?
Today, the rule of thumb is that a hybrid vehicle is about $3,000 more than a conventional vehicle. And at today's gas prices, there's about a 4 or 5 year payback on that. Plug-in hybrids are going to be a few thousand dollars more, but the added savings between using electricity instead of very expensive gasoline will recover that cost.
Maybe now, but I mean, when everyone's using electric cars, you know, we'll be in a supply and demand situation there as well. Quickly, though, Mark, is there the hottest car on the lot right now? Is there the GTO of the plug-in 2008? Quickly.
Oh, there's some great cars. There's a Ford Escape, plug-in
Ford
hybrid
Escape.
SUV,
all right.
A Saturn View.
We don't have time for the whole list, but sounds like you're a pig in it there at the conference. Mark Duvall is Program Manager for Electric Transportation at the Electric Power Research Center. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Yes, thank you. It's a great show. Thank you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, July 23rd. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. It's The Takeaway. Dean Clayton, you're on the line from Birmingham, England. How are you doing this morning?
I'm fine, thank you. Nice to meet you.
Dean, how many times during the day do you want your hands to turn into, like, big, long, piercing knives?
Not many, unfortunately. I don't think it'd help me with my day job. But if I could sort of create extra copies of myself, that would be really useful.
Dean Clayton.
Get work done quicker.
Dean Clayton is founder of the website UncannyXMen.net, and we are speaking with him because this is an X-Men fan site on the day that the 500th issue of the comic book X-Men is published. And Dean, this is an event. This is a historic event, correct?
Oh, yes. Sure it is. I mean, you know, the X-Men have been around since 1963, you know, and it's obviously going to take quite a long time to reach 500 comic books to be released on a monthly basis.
But this is a storyline about people with fabulous advantages, but they act like they're outcasts. People with superpowers who are actually sort of shunned by the rest of the world. What appeals to you about that storyline?
Well, I think everyone feels like an outcast, to be honest. You know, whether you're part of a minority, you know, whether it's for religious or you know, sexual preference or anything like that. And it's the fact that people can obviously identify with these people that are persecuted because of what they are.
And do you identify with a particular X-Men?
There's a couple of characters. I mean, I think when someone like myself, who's probably followed the comics for quite a while, you get, you start to appreciate some of the characters that aren't in the comics, you know, month in, month out, some of the sort of the fringe characters. Personally, I think there's a couple of characters. For instance, there's a character called Jamie Madrox, who's known as Multiple Man.
Multiple Man, you said?
That's correct, yes. Mm-hmm. So the idea being that is if he sort of hits or any kind of sort of, you know, physical sort of contact in that kind of way, he creates a duplicate of himself.
And that's the one that you particularly like, yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the reasons I like it is the way that he's sort of currently written is on the basis of the fact that each duplicate has a slightly different personality. So, you know, he could be perhaps in some kind of large fight and creates a duplicate of himself to help him, but that duplicate's a pacifist and doesn't want nothing to do with the fight and runs away.
What really impresses me about X-Men is how psychological it is. Even though there's a lot of fighting and battling with the establishment, there's a whole psychological dimension to all the characters. Is that what drives you into this series?
Oh, totally. I mean, it's a sense of belonging to a family. You know, it might not be sort of a biological family, you know, because relatives and what have you, but it's a family of people drawn with coming from the same perspective, have the same sort of issues, and trying to obviously better themselves and hopefully society as well.
Well, Dean Clayton, thanks for joining us. He's the founder of the website UncannyXMen.net. It's an X-Men fan site on the day or the week that the 500th issue of Uncanny X-Men is published. Did you see the movies, the X-Men movies?
I did. I liked all of them, and I'd like to
be
Halle Berry. I'd like to be Halle Berry. I'd like to be Storm. I'd love to control the weather.
Control the weather. And what would you do if you control the weather? Would you be outcast?
I would keep it sunny on the days I was happy, and boy, would it be storming on the days I wasn't.
That's not outcast. That's more master of the universe, I think.
Well, I'll take that one, too.
Yeah, that's another comic.
I mean, what superpower do you want? You could quickly.
Oh, to vanish. There, I just did it.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, July 23rd, and we have the latest headline for you, or at least Femi Okei does.
Thanks, Adora. 12 minutes to the hour. Condoleezza Rice says she had a good meeting with her North Korean counterpart in Singapore this morning in talks about ending North Korea's nuclear program. The United States and the European Union say they are pleased with Serbia for capturing accused war criminal Radovan Karadzic and are urging Serbia to follow up by arresting his right-hand man, Ratko Mladic. Barack Obama has toured Israel's Holocaust Memorial, where he laid a wreath in memory of the 6 million Jews who died. Later today, he'll head to the West Bank to meet with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. The House is set to vote today on a massive housing bill that would help bail out homeowners hurt by the housing crisis. The bill may also provide billions in taxpayer money to save mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Texas residents are heading to shelters as Hurricane Dolly bears down on the Gulf Coast. And this morning we spoke to Dennis Felton from NOAA, and Dennis actually said that this hurricane is due to be a horrific rainmaker when all is said and done. Already in Mexico, 23,000 people are in shelters and the roads are packed as people are trying to get out of the way. They don't have much longer. They've got about 4 hours before those outer bands, those big thunderstorms, begin to hit land.
So a strong storm and disruptive storm, but perhaps not destructive.
It's going to be the rain that's going to be the problem, and for a couple of days as well. So we're going to see a couple of days of very severe flooding.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Now we're going to the medical front, where we're going to take a look at two diseases where there are some great hopes given developments against prostate cancer and Alzheimer's, two diseases that have certainly stymied and frustrated doctors. And we're going to start with prostate cancer. For that, we're going to have Dr. Anthony D'Amico join us. He's a professor and chief of radiation oncology at the Dana-Farber and Brigham Hospital, and that would be in Boston. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning.
So tell us about this new treatment for prostate cancer that is triggering such great hopes.
Well, it's called abiraterone, and it's a drug that takes the hormone that feeds prostate cancer, called testosterone, down to a zero level in the body. It's more effective than any other hormonal therapy in bringing testosterone levels down than we've ever had before. And there is promise that this may even be able to help men whose prostate cancer has left the prostate and spread to the bone.
Doctor, that almost sounds like a miracle.
Well, they don't come too often. The final word, though, will come from an international clinical trial that's being conducted currently. And it's going to enroll several hundred people from around the world to test this drug against the best drugs we currently have for advanced and metastatic prostate cancer.
Is it a little early to be making those kind of predictions, given that so far the testing has only involved a trial of 21 people in Britain?
I think what we can say so far is that this treatment is more effective than any other hormonal therapy that we have for prostate cancer in reducing testosterone down to zero. The real answer, though, will come from the large international study that's going to enroll hundreds of patients from around the world. I think the promise, though, is that we've never had a drug that's so effective in taking testosterone down to such a low level, and we know that testosterone feeds prostate cancer. So logic would have it that this probably will be at least better than the best hormonal therapy we currently have.
Doctor, what's the potential that this could replace the complicated and sometimes very, very difficult and debilitating surgical therapies that victims of prostate cancer often face?
I think that's not likely, because this medicine is really geared at cancers that are more advanced, already beyond what surgery could handle. So the less advanced cancers would probably still be handled with surgery or radiation, but the more advanced cancers may be handled with this drug.
There's also been reports that the mechanism that allows the testosterone to be cut off is also being looked at in breast cancer in trying to figure out whether or not you could apply it to the estrogen, which feeds breast cancer.
Exactly. This whole thing is based on a chemical pathway. And the difference between this drug and other drugs that are used to treat prostate cancer is this one stops testosterone delivery or function at step one. The same thing could be thought about in terms of estrogen production in breast cancer, if you could stop it earlier in its path.
Well, sometimes therapies relate to specific pathways and strategies that are well-known hormonal strategies here in prostate cancer, which is what the doctor is talking about. Joining us now is Dr. Samuel Gandy, who's Associate Director of the Mount Sinai Alzheimer's Disease Research Center and Chair of the National Medical and Scientific Advisory Council of the Alzheimer's Association. He has some information about a drug which wasn't particularly known for being a therapy for Alzheimer's, which is suddenly showing great promise there. An old Russian antihistamine has made its way back onto the medical market to treat Alzheimer's. Dr. Gandy, thanks for joining us, and explain how this works.
Good morning. Thanks for your interest. This is a drug called Dimebon, spelled D-I-M-E-B-O-N, and had in its previous clinical use been used to treat hay fever in Russia, as you said, an antihistamine, something you would never think of as improving brain function because they tend to be sedating and could cause confusion in the elderly. But a Russian scientist was seeking a medicine that would potentially mimic some of the existing Alzheimer drugs. And in that pursuit, he hit upon this medicine that seemed to help brain function or help behavior in mouse memory or rat memory studies, and that's how the whole thing started.
And now you're in a phase three clinical trial of a off-label use. I mean, the drug is already approved as an antihistamine, but this would be an attempt to get it officially approved as an Alzheimer's treatment.
Well, it's not approved in this country as an antihistamine. That's a Russian approval. So it's not something you can go out and buy right now. But yes, it looked very promising in a phase two trial that was done in Russia, but directed by American neuropsychologists and Alzheimer experts. And this medicine, the Dimebon, showed an increase in cognitive function, improvement in memory in the first few months, and then stabilization, which seemed to persist for up to a year. And we typically see medicines that have an initial bump upward, but then the slope of decline parallels that of the control group. That is, they sort of set the clock back 6 months, but then they begin declining at the same rate. this seemed to stabilize the rate at a higher function than when they started.
Well, quickly to both of you, Dr. D'Amico and Dr. Gandy, I guess the story here for both of you is that sometimes drugs lead to new therapies, and sometimes therapies actually lead to new drugs. But in the case of both of these diseases, the drug is just the beginning. Dr. D'Amico?
That's correct. And what we need to discover now is whether or not this drug will lead us to, as was alluded to before, help in other areas such as breast cancer and other hormone-dependent tumors.
Dr. Gandy, I'll give you the last word.
Yeah, I think this illustrates that in science, sometimes it's important to design a perfect experiment, and sometimes it's important to recognize something significant when you just stumble onto it.
So the combination of stumbling and paying attention scientifically has produced some very powerful results this morning for us. Dr. Samuel Gandy is Associate Director of the Mount Sinai Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, and Dr. Anthony D'Amico is Professor in Chief of Genitourinary Radiation Oncology at Dana-Farber and Brigham Hospital. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Boy, that was interesting.
It is, and it sounds promising.
It sounds promising on both levels. And, you know, it really is going back to our mission to catch scientists in the act, as you like to say. It's one part stumbling and being attentive to what's actually working, and another part methodically, strategically going after a goal that you know might work.
And I'm not sure that journalists often show restraint in those headlines. Doctors qualify everything,
yeah,
right? They say,
do.
This is the first step. This is the first step to understanding the mechanism and this mechanism, and then we got to go to the next step, and then we go to the next step afterwards. So we will check in with them again and
Absolutely.
See how those drugs are working.
Yes, very, very interesting. All right, we're taking a look at the future of the electric car here on The Takeaway. The 500th issue of X-Men goes on sale today. What superpower do you want? Business schools turn to hand scans to prevent cheating. Is that going to work? When do you cheat? Come on. We've been asking you all morning, and you're not coming through.
We're also asking you about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Our friend Dana Franchitto, he weighed in. Is it socialism or what? What the Congress is debating today about helping those two mortgage giants out with.
The bailout of these big financial markets by the government is capitalism at its most hypocritical. What they're doing here is privatizing their gains and socializing their losses. And these are the people who are always telling us to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps.
Well, Dana has a point there.
Takeaway for me is I learned my co-host wants to control the weather.
I love weather.
No, you can sign up for our weekly email newsletter and find out what weather Adora is making anywhere in your town. It's all at www.thetakeaway.org. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.